Thank you, operator, and thank you for everyone for taking the time to join today's call. I'm Corey Smith. I'm Vice President of Policy, Advocacy, and Communications for Kids in Need of Defense. Our call today will include four policy experts that I will introduce in just a minute to cover the latest developments and analysis of the Trump administration's executive order and the effects it will have on children and their families at the border. Having said that, we still remain very concerned about the families that are separated. It is unclear, per the executive order, if there are instances where families can still be separated. And we also have no sense or clarity on the process of family reunification. So we are very concerned about the family separations that have occurred and the process to reunify those that have been separated. Our first speaker will be Wendy Young, President of Kids in Need of Defense. Wendy will be followed by Michelle Bernay, Director of the Migrant Rights and Justice Women's Refugee Commission. Michelle will be followed by Dr. Alan Shapiro with the American Academy of Pediatrics and also the Medical Director and Co-Founder of Terra Firma. And after Dr. Shapiro will be Ashley Feasley, Director of Policy for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. After our speakers have finished, we will have plenty of time for questions when I cue the operator for questions. And with that, I will turn it over to our first speaker, Wendy Young, President of Kids in Need of Defense. Wendy?
Thank you, Corey, and thanks for joining us today. First, I want to say I think it's important to give credit where credit is due. The inhumane family separation, or so-called zero-tolerance policy, was reversed because of the groundswell of outrage from the American public, not because the Trump administration found their heart in some Wizard of Oz moment. And this is really underscored by the fact that the executive order that was issued yesterday will continue to needlessly punish families who have committed no crime other than to have simply asked us for our help and protection from the violence that's occurring in Central America. Bottom line, what the executive order is doing is replacing one incredibly harsh policy with another incredibly harsh policy. So what I'm going to do now is just run through very quickly some of our concerns about the executive order. First, it leaves the zero tolerance policy intact, which means that prosecution of parents who arrive with their children will continue. Second, very concerning, it will result in innocent families being detained on a prolonged basis together as a family unit, but with no standards in place in terms of the quality of care that they will be provided, the types of facilities in which they will be provided, or for how long they will be detained. Next, it fast-tracks the immigration hearings of these families, which includes ahead of people who have committed crimes in the United States, and there is no time period defined for those hearings. And if you look at some of the proposals that have been presented on the Hill, some are talking about hearings that are as short as 14 days. That's virtually impossible for families to present an asylum claim in such a short turnaround period. Next, it closes the U.S. border even further by requiring asylum seekers to present themselves at ports of entry if they want to avoid criminal prosecution and at certain times with no definition of what that time may be. We have already witnessed families being pushed back into Mexico and told to wait because there's a lack of capacity at the ports of entry to process them. So we're concerned that this could result in even further restrictions, which means that the ports of entry effectively become non-starter in terms of allowing people to come in and exercise their right to seek asylum. Next, and we've already seen the administration present a filing to the court in California. They are seeking to reopen the Flores class action settlement agreement, which Michelle Bernay will talk about in more detail, but that's a very important framework for establishing standards for the care and custody of children in immigration detention. And they are seeking to change the Flores agreement to basically excise children who arrive with their families from coverage of Flores, which opens the door wide to holding these children in substandard conditions. And finally, it formally states that the Department of Defense will now be involved in immigration detention programs. This is the first time that we've seen the Defense Department suggested that they play an active role in the detention program. Previously, military bases, as you may know, have been used on a triage basis to provide emergency space as needed. but we are concerned that the Defense Department playing an active and formal role could further militarize our immigration system. So I will stop there and turn it over to Ms. Alberne. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you, everybody, for joining. So I want to start by just making clear the administration continues to talk about loopholes that need to be fixed with legislation. There are no loopholes, and the loopholes they are referring to are child protection standards that are mandated by the Flores settlement. So this isn't a choice between detention of children with their families or separation of children and detention of their parents. That is a false choice that is being offered by the administration. There are many other options, but primarily there are alternatives that Ashley will talk about later on the call. The key here is that the Flores settlement is an agreement between the government that resulted from litigation about standards of care for children in government custody. Migrant children were being held in standards that did not meet basic United States child protection protocols. And so what the settlement laid out was sort of a framework for what has to happen when you have children in immigration custody. And that begins with a presumption of not holding them in detention. And it says that they need to reunify children. Children belong in communities, not in institutional settings and not in detention, and that therefore children should be reunified as soon as practicable with their family or directly with their parents or other family members. And that if they have to be detained, if they have to be held for short periods or even for longer periods, that they have to be held in licensed, appropriate child-friendly environments that are not secure. And by not secure, they mean not, you know, not prison-like, not criminal facilities. And that's basically what Flores says. The administration is seeking a waiver of Flores. They're trying to say that Flores shouldn't apply to children who are with their parents. They're trying to say that they need a waiver of the licensing requirements, which basically means they're saying they don't want to be required to meet child protection standards that you need to meet in order to get a license. And they're trying to say that this is because they are in a crisis mode and they have to deal with large numbers of children that they and they need to prosecute parents. None of the above, you know, is justification for Flores and is not even true. So, of course, child welfare standards apply to all children. Flores was very clear on that in the settlement, and we feel very strongly that it makes no sense to waive child welfare standards simply because a child is being detained in custody with a parent. Licensing, of course, is necessary if you want to ensure that the child welfare standards are met. Before the Flores settlement was put into place and before family detention facilities were required to meet the standards of Flores, we saw really horrific conditions of children in custody. Wendy can, I'm sure, jump in on this because she has been working on this for a very long time, just as I have. But we saw children in prison uniforms. We saw children being mixed in with criminal populations, children who had no recreation, who were held in custody. I saw kids held in immigration family detention centers for over 2 years. There were parents threatened to have their children taken away if their children didn't behave. Children told me that they were afraid they would be sent away and their mommies punished if they weren't quiet. So the conditions really can deteriorate drastically without some kind of standards and monitoring of these facilities. Why is the administration asking for a waiver? And that the reason they're asking for waivers of Flores is because family detention has never been found to be compliant with Flores. They have been unable to get licenses, and they've had continued issues regarding conditions. And in fact, many experts, courts and experts from various parts of our country and society have found repeatedly that the family detention centers are an entirely inappropriate place for children. In 2015, I was part of a federal advisory committee on the the family residential centers. We had experts from the medical community, from the mental health community, from the education community, from the security community, and unanimously we found that we actually could not make any logical recommendations for running an appropriate family residential center. We found unanimously that the detention of children in these facilities should be avoided at all costs. And then finally, just to say again that this is not a real crisis. This is a crisis manufactured by this administration because from the very beginning, their objective has been to eliminate Flores and to not have to comply with these basic child welfare standards. Thank you.
Okay, next we'll have Dr. Shapiro.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for inviting me today. I am a pediatrician who has had fairly extensive experience working with unaccompanied immigrant children and families seeking asylum in our Terra Firma program in New York City. We've seen over 500 unaccompanied children and families. I've also visited multiple family detention centers, Customs and Border Protection processing centers, and unaccompanied immigrant children shelters. And I tell you that because that experience that I have had and that my colleagues have had who wrote the American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement wanted to see with our own eyes really what was going on in these centers before we wrote our policy. I represent the American Academy of Pediatrics as well, and there are 66,000 pediatricians who have all been extremely concerned about the enormous stress that separation has on a child and on the detention of immigrant children. Although separation has probably stopped based on the executive order, there are still over 2,300 children that are separated, and we are extremely concerned about the health and well-being of those children. We are worried about the short and long-term effects. In the short term, we are really worried about acute traumatic stress disorder and the behavioral regression and loss of developmental milestones that we can see with that, such as bedwetting, problems with sleeping and eating, severe depression and anxiety. And very much we're worried about their ability to learn because they are having difficulty concentrating and are hypervigilant about the new surroundings that they're in. It is very, very concerning to us. But we're also concerned about the long-term effects on children. We know that children who are exposed to prolonged stress and hormones that are released in the body when the body is stressed, the fight and flight hormones, leads to changes in physiology that affect every organ system. That in turn, that toxic stress, and let me make it clear, toxic stress is not only the exposure to prolonged stress hormones, but it is the lacking of a buffering parent, a buffering loving caregiver that leads to toxic stress. And so we are very worried about those effects. Those effects can lead to cardiovascular disease such as hypertension, it can lead to diabetes, and it can lead to major depression. But we also know that detention is bad. Separation is egregious, but detention is extremely bad for children. When we wrote our policy statement, our recommendations are that based on all the scientific evidence and studies that no child or family unit with a child should ever be in detention. These families are not a security threat to society. They should be released to family members in the community and not kept in detention. There's no scientific evidence that any amount of time in detention is safe for children. And in fact, the evidence says the opposite, that even short periods of detention can lead to psychological trauma and long-term mental health risks for children. Studies show that children who are detained showed signs of both physical and emotional distress, and I've seen that with my own eyes at shelters, children who show developmental delays, children who were talking, who stopped talking, children who were toilet trained, who started bedwetting, children that became anxious, clinging, and withdrawn. One of the most concerning things that I saw in at the Berks Family Detention Center was a child that was chewing on his arm, really engaging in self-mutilating behavior, and of course, children that expressed suicidal ideation. I would add, though, that family detention also leads to depression and other mental health effects on the parent. And I want to stress that. If a parent isn't there to buffer their child during detention, again, that can lead to toxic stress and all the effects that I just mentioned. So it's very important that these families are released. Lastly, I just want to say that we also were extremely concerned at our visits to the Customs and Border Processing Center, where the conditions were, we felt, really harsh to keep children in cages, in freezing cold temperatures, poor food choices, and very, very cursory medical care. My own statement would be that when we dehumanize children, when we dehumanize immigrant families, it allows us to do things like put children in cages and separate families, and separate children from the families. And I'll leave it at that right now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Shapiro. And now we'll turn it over to Ashley Feasley, the Policy Director for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Thank you very much, Corey. Just to follow up on what Dr. Shapiro said, obviously, I think, the Pope has spoken about his concern on the separation of families, and the bishops themselves were very concerned. And as we talk about the large-scale detention of families, that also is a concern for those who provide child welfare services and know about kind of the deleterious effects of family detention on children. So there's been a lot of discussion about the need for Congress to find a solution, but I think the reality is that there is no, piece of legislation that will be quite as effective as looking at some of the programs and the policy solutions that are actually in place right now that could be utilized to prevent family separation and also to prevent large-scale family detention. I'm referring to alternatives to detention. So alternatives to detention are programs that are used in lieu of putting individuals in immigrant detention here in the United States. We have used them for many years, and there's a number of existing alternatives to detention that could be implemented immediately. Programs such as the ISAP program, which is an intensive supervision appearance program that was created in 2004, that is currently a program that ICE uses. Another very important program that could be implemented is a program called the Family Case Management Program, the FCMP. Now, this was a program that was created specifically for arriving family units. It was stood up in 2016, and it ended in July of 2017. And it served arriving family units with a mechanism called community support and case management. This meant that individual families would go to where their family is, but be monitored by DHS, ICE, to ensure that they were complying with their immigration proceedings. Many faith-based and other child welfare and immigrant advocate groups were able to assist with this program in the five cities that it operated. Most importantly, the program had a 99% compliance rate, and it was cheaper than the cost for the per night cost for family detention beds. So I think that there are existing policy and programmatic solutions that can be implemented immediately to ensure that we don't have to detain families at this time that have been proven to show compliance and also be more cost effective.
Okay, thank you so much, Ashley. Now, operator, we're ready for questions.
Certainly, thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. If your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing 1. Again, ladies and gentlemen, it's star 1. And our first question comes from Yeha Terbati from Reuters. Go ahead.
Hi, it's Yegana Torbati with Reuters. Thanks so much for having this, the call. Could anyone on the call speak sort of about the capacity issues at Carnes and Dilley and Berks and sort of what you foresee happening if we start to see a large influx of families into these centers?
This is Michelle. I can speak to this a bit, and I don't know, maybe Ashley, you can jump in. The facilities are currently not full. They have not been sending families to those facilities for quite some time since they started separating. So there is space there now, but obviously, as you can imagine, if they do start sending everybody there, they will fill up unless they release families from that facility. So part of it is it's hard to know until we see exactly how this plays out in terms of some of the choices they're able to make. But what they have indicated is that they are going to immediately start building facilities or setting facilities up on military bases. There's been that implication. That could, in theory, be done fairly quickly. It depends on how much money they want to spend and how much energy they put into it. In the past, the Obama administration built a facility in Artesia, New Mexico, on a CBP training camp, and they did that in a matter of weeks, so it's possible, but I will say that that facility had massive issues with it. They were not even close to being compliant, not only with child standards, but not even with adult standards. So we'll have to see what happens, but potentially they will be trying to do that. And I'll just jump in there and say that that will cost billions of dollars of taxpayer money, so that will be another issue that they're going to have to face. And the program that Ashley mentioned is not just a little bit cheaper. The Family Case Management Program costs $35 more or less a day per person, as opposed to the many thousands of dollars per day per person that they would be spending on family detention.
So this is Ashley, and I think Michelle's absolutely right, but I do want to talk a little bit about looking at the language of the executive order. There is an intention that they will be trying to process the families' asylum claims within that 20-day period that, you know, the kids are allowed to stay in a family detention facility per the Flores litigation. And I just want to frame, I used to work at one of the organizations that's providing direct service in the Dilley, the South Texas Family Residential Facility. And, it's very, very difficult, I think, for a lot of these families, given the trauma that they've experienced, to be able to start to kind of explain what happened to them. And it will very much, I think, be difficult for them to be able to, you know, access justice and adequately explain, given, you know, kind of that time crunch situation. So we are looking at what could be a real stress on the family's ability to meaningfully, access protection and claim asylum.
Thank you for that. Can I just ask a quick follow-up? Hello?
Sure. Please go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Thanks. Do you have any concerns about, the 2016 report that a couple of you at least were on the advisory commission for, you know, talked about, and I think lawsuits as well have sort of talked about, like, medical shortages of medical staff. Do you have any concerns about that? Do you have concerns about staffing issues that ICE will run into if they put more families into these facilities? If you can sort of speak a little bit about that, that would be helpful.
This is Alan Shapiro. One thing I can say is that when we when we went to Carnes Family Detention Center before we wrote our report, and I had been multiple times to Burke's Family Detention Center, and we were really concerned that there was a lack of guideline-based pediatric care for the children in those centers. We were really what we were most concerned about, and I know that groups from the American Psychological Association who've also visited Burke's were also concerned about the mental health services. No formal screening was done. No periodic formal screening was done. Inadequate mental health services for the families. And what we saw was the result of that. What we saw was the result of the lack of services. And I am really worried, as I am sure my colleagues are, that there will not be adequate services for these families, which is why release into the community is so essential.
And I promise this will be my last follow-up, but Dr. Shapiro, do you have any reason to believe that, I think that report came out in like September 2016, so right before the Obama administration went out of office. Do you have any reason to believe that the problems that you identified there, especially with the mental health issues, have been resolved or have changed in sort of the year and a half or 2 years since then?
I have no evidence to believe that things have changed, and we never really saw any interest in getting recommendations for us to make changes. So I am highly skeptical. And as the numbers swell, I think we'll be, and you know, two of the family detention centers in Texas, Carnes and Dilley, are run by for-profit prison corporations. And so, you know, for them to hire many more medical and mental health professionals is going to cost them money. And I think there's a conflict of interest with for-profit prison corporations being overseeing healthcare services.
Thank you so much. Very helpful.
Thank you. Next question.
And our next question comes from Michael Shear from the New York Times. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, guys. Thank you very much for doing this. If you could react to this report that's out there now about the military being asked to provide facilities that would be for up to 20,000 unaccompanied migrants, their families with children. Does that seem like the kind of numbers that you would expect? And can you give any sense of what's happening actually on the ground today? There seems to be a lot of confusion about whether people are being prosecuted, where they're being held, whether they're being held at ICE, handed over to the U.S. Marshals, whether the Justice Department is actually charging them or not. Does anybody have any sort of first or secondhand knowledge of what's been happening today in the hours after the president's executive order went into effect? And thank you.
This is Wendy Young from KIND. I can take a crack at the first question if somebody wants to handle the second part of it. In terms of the 20,000 spaces and unaccompanied children being held by the Defense Department, that would be highly, highly concerning to us, whether it's an unaccompanied child or a family. You know, obviously the Defense Department is charged with protecting our national security. They're not a child welfare agency. And it's taken us 30 years to build a system within the immigration system that incrementally has started to improve the treatment of children and recognize their unique vulnerabilities as they enter our immigration system. So, you know, the system has never been far from perfect, but certainly we've seen a positive trajectory over the years in terms of the treatment of unaccompanied children. So it seems like what this administration is doing, what's taken us 30 years to build, it's taking them about 3 months to destruct. So we're quite concerned about that. And I'll leave it to somebody else to answer the second part of your question.
This is Michelle with the Women's Refugee Commission. I agree wholeheartedly with Wendy on that. And, you know, anytime you have those kinds of large numbers of children in one place, especially if it's being operated on a military base and with for-profit implementers, there's going to be concerns. I'll just say that. But regarding what's happening on the ground today, I do not have any firsthand information because I'm not at the border anymore. I'm back in D.C. But I will say that in my conversations with various people both at ORR, at ICE, and on the ground that there is, exactly as you say, a lot of confusion. There's conflicting instructions and information being given, even to the government actors here. And it's just another example, I think, of the standard operating procedure of this administration, which is to make these big, bold policy announcements with no plan for how they're going to implement them. And frankly, it's just adding to the chaos on the ground, which feeds into their request then for needing some sort of an emergency response and saying that they need legislation or something. It's all manufactured by them and not actually necessary.
Okay, next question.
Certainly. The next question comes from Mary Jo Pissel from AZ Republic. Go ahead, Mary Jo.
Yes, what are the methods that have been identified thus far to track the 2,300 or so children who were separated and get them back to their parents? I understand there's not a process, but as you work through that, what kind of tools can you use to try to connect children, figure out where they're at, and get them back to mom and dad?
This is Wendy Young. I can take a crack at that, but welcome the thoughts of the other speakers. Thus far, we have seen no evidence that any system has been put in place by the government to ensure that these families are communicating or reunifying. So it continues to be a chaotic process. Now, some of us in the NGO community on an ad hoc basis have been trying to reconnect children with their families, but it is incredibly challenging when you've got the parent in the custody of one federal agency in an adult detention center, a child in the custody of another federal agency locked up. Trying to facilitate this has been extraordinarily difficult, and we at KIND, for example, have worked on cases where the parent's actually been deported, child's left behind in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and we're trying to find help that poor parent who's frantic find where their child is.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, it feels like my legal services staff have become private investigators. They're trying to connect the dots with what little we might have. That might be the name, date of birth, the A number, but we've found some cases where there's inaccuracies in the data, which has led to further challenges, so it's taking a long time when we do engage. And that's assuming, by the way, that the parent is able to connect with a KIND or an organization such as ours.
So this is Ashley, and we provide, at the Bishops Conference, we provide services to unaccompanied children, family reunification, long-term foster care, in partnership with HHS. And just to kind of echo but give a little bit different perspective with Wendy, we've seen a tremendous strain on our, you know, frontline social workers who very much have seen, with real difficulty, trying to interface just in terms of making a point of connection with mom or dad, who is in a completely different, department of the executive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been something, I think we've been working with the consulates, trying to engage with them, obviously with legal service providers, but it does provide, I think, a strain, and it is a little bit of investigative work, especially because as providers, we are not given the numbers of the number of children who may be in our care who have been separated. So it is a challenge. I think we are all working to engage on it, but it does really illustrate the need for a mechanism and increased engagement by the government in general. This was a need before the implementation of this policy, and it'll continue to be a need.
And I would just add for just one moment to add to some of the craziness of this. Even the government doesn't have the necessary information for connecting these families, and in some cases when they've separated these young children, they haven't even taken the proper information to be able to share it with ORR or any of the people trying to put the families back together. I've had numerous calls in which we've been able to somehow piece together nicknames versus actual names being put down for children, or children not knowing their real names. If you haven't heard the story already, actually found a child in the Ursula facility that was listed by CBP as being 2 years old and under a different name than her actual name. She was being cared for by other children in the facility. She was still in diapers. She spoke only K'iche, and nobody could understand what she was saying. After we dug around, we determined that she was actually 4 years old, had a different name, and that her aunt was in the same facility, locked in a different cage. So we identified that case with a lot of labor, and really just coincidentally, because I happened to pick that name from a list of over 500 children's names to speak to. I don't know how many others like that there may be out there.
Wow. So it's just a lot of picking up strands and trying to follow, to run them down. There's no number that stays with the child, no like wristband that might stay with them.
They do now, and I don't know the date that this was implemented, but when I was in McAllen last week, I was told that it was a new policy. They started assigning families who were apprehended together what they call a family identity unit or something like that, or identity number. And so it would be separate from their case number. Everybody in that family would have the same number. That makes sense. My concern is that I think it was not implemented literally until last week, so the last week of this policy being in place. And again, we found some mistakes there where I would find families that didn't have the same number, or I would find one person who had the number and nobody else that I could match it up with. But it's a start.
This is Wendy Young from Kind again. Just one last comment on all of this. Ashley's organization, the program she was speaking of, the work that we do at Kind in terms of providing legal services, these are programs that are already stretching to reach the needs of the unaccompanied children, the children who truly did arrive alone in the United States and are being put into the ORR system. We are striving very hard to meet the needs of these children. We've now introduced an additional 2,300 children on top of that population who have tremendously complex needs, as you've just heard, by virtue of having been separated from their family.
Mm-hmm.
So it is putting an additional strain on an already strained system, and really it's being done very intentionally and very needlessly by the administration.
Thank you.
Operator, next question.
Certainly. The next question comes from Monica Campbell from Kind. Go ahead, Monica.
Hi, I'm with Public Radio International's The World. I have a question about the three family detention centers that exist, the two in Texas and the one in Pennsylvania, Berks. What can we say about those facilities? Any idea on how many families are in those facilities now? And would we see people being moved to those ICE-run facilities?
I can take this, and Michelle, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Ashley.
So there are three facilities, as you mentioned. One is Berks in Pennsylvania, and it's kind of the legacy facility. And it's got up over 100 beds, but not quite 200 beds. The two facilities in Texas are located in Billy, Texas, and then Karnes City, Texas. They are larger scale facilities. The Karnes facility has about 600 beds, and the Dilley facility has about 1,400 beds. And so I think it's really important to understand, those facilities. Michelle mentioned the facility in Artesia, New Mexico that was stood up in the summer of 2014. These facilities were very quickly stood up basically in 2015, right at around Christmas time. The facility, when Artesia in New Mexico closes, the Dilley facility opened. It's run by formerly the Corrections Corporation of America, and the Karnes facility is run by GEO Corporation. So both facilities are seeing increased numbers, but not at capacity at this point in time. We could see families move there, I think, literally today. To kind of the point about how much action is going on here today, I think that it is uncertain the type of movement we're going to see. But I do want to flag the fact that, the facilities, the two Texas facilities, kind of have these housing pods. And so some of the decisions on where to place people are based on kind of the size of the family unit. And previously, we did not have male-led households, so dads with kids were not admitted into those facilities. It was just female-led households, so mom and kids. I think it is very early to tell whether we will be seeing that different, but it does create a new problem with the regulations. I also want to note of the two facilities, and I think Michelle mentioned this at the beginning of the call, and if not, both of these facilities are under extensive litigation because they do not currently have child welfare licensing. So they are, you know, facilities that I think, you know, we have concerns about the care, and they haven't been granted that license.
Thank you. And just to follow up, I mean, doesn't Floris require licensing, and wouldn't they be in violation of that if they housed children there?
So Floris applies here in the sense that they can't be there for longer than 20 days. There mm-hmm. was litigation that was initiated, I believe, by the ACLU in part due to the number of children and the length of time that they were staying in the Carnes and Dilley facility, and some of the statements by the Obama administration that this was a means of deterrence. And one of the conditions from Judge G's order was that, you know, there's a 20-day period. Now, I think in the executive order that was issued yesterday by the administration, I believe that he instructs the Attorney General to actually petition on the Flores. So we will see, I imagine, litigation on this issue.
This is Michelle. Can I just clarify a little bit about the 20 days? So what Flores says is that children can be held temporarily in facilities until they're screened or processed. But that after that initial, and it's traditionally, we talk about 72 hours in which children have to be transferred out of these border or processing facilities, but it could also be up to a week for needs. Flores has language that says that exempts the government from that limitation of how long they can hold the child in a non-licensed facility in cases of what they call an influx. So when the litigation happened that we're talking about, the more recent litigation about the family facilities, the judge sort of agreed that there were a lot of cases and that the government made a claim that they needed more time to process these families, that they weren't able to meet the demand for the numbers. And so as a result, the judge said that 20 days seemed reasonable given what they were, the numbers they were dealing with, and that they were unprepared. So I think that there's some question there. 20 days is not a hard line date number. It really is supposed to be within a reasonable amount of time. So there, as a result, those facilities currently, the government has sort of clung on to that 20 days, and they are releasing families for the most part after the 20 days. This is why they want a waiver. Their facilities are not licensed, so they cannot hold them beyond that reasonable period, and they're asking for that length of time to be extended or to be taken away so that they don't have to have a license at all. And what that means, I mean, the reason this is important, this isn't just a random license. This is a license that, you know, requires child protection standards. This is how you measure whether they are meeting the standards. And basic, this is not anything special for unaccompanied children. This is a standard, basic standard in the United States for how we treat children that they have a right to, basically constitutionally.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. Operator, next question.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, it's star one. And it appears to be no further questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, operator. So with that, we'll end today's call, and we appreciate everyone's time. Thank you.
Thank you.